Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. If Israel does strike Iran, will Iran decide to become a nuclear power? Could Iran already be one? Also, the conventional wisdom is foreign policy doesn't play a role in American presidential politics. Well, in this campaign, it certainly does. To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And in Istanbul, we cross to Tariq Cyril Ahmad. He is a historian and political commentator. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick this off with George in Budapest. The world is waiting for Israel's reaction to the retaliation that Iran conducted weeks ago. And this has put Iran in a very difficult position because we will go up the escalation ladder. And part of going up the escalation ladder has been an issue that has been around for a long time, that Iran may feel that it has no other choice but to develop its own nuclear weapon, which, of course, is something that the United States would find intolerable. Of course, Israel would. But what choices does Iran have? It's existential at this point.
Yeah, you're right, Peter. What choice does Iran have? Iran, quite a number of years ago now, made this, I think, a rather odd decision not to develop nuclear weapons. It said it, you know, there was a fatwa and issued, and there have been repeated fatwas issued over the years that they have no intention of developing nuclear weapons. And I said that it's odd because Iran has obviously seen what has happened to powers that essentially abjured the use of or the development of nuclear weapons. They saw the invasion of Iraq. They saw the onslaught on Libya. Both powers, which once aspired to develop nuclear weapons, then gave them up and were obviously then ripe for the pickings. But Iran nonetheless did so. And it was odd also because the two powers that really are out to get Iran, that who really have a deep, almost existential hatred for Iran, namely Israel and the United States, are both nuclear powers. And so Iran has really remained in this increasingly vulnerable position. And it's particularly vulnerable now when we see Israel seeking to reorder the Middle East, and Israel now seeking that its understanding that its main adversary, the main leader of the opposition, the main leader of the axis of resistance, is Iran. So Iran is really the target, and it's known that it is absolutely in the crosshairs of Israel's, and because behind Israel stands the United States. So now that Israel is making a plan for a big strike, and it could well be a big strike, which is, you know, hitting either its oil field, its oil refineries, or even its nuclear facilities, it's hard to see how Iran can just simply give up and say, no, we'll continue with this policy of not developing nuclear weapons. I think that if Israel does, and I assume Israel will strike in the near future, Iran will have to essentially move towards developing nuclear weapons.
Well, and we all know, Iran is a very sophisticated society. They have the brain power. Obviously, Israel has been assassinating their scientists. So if the decision is made, it could be done relatively quickly. I mean, it's not really a technological challenge. If it's a decision they make, they can do it quite easily. Tariq, I mean, this is serious business. I mean, we've seen Gaza turned into a wasteland, uninhabitable. The same thing is happening now in Lebanon, particularly with Beirut and the Bekaa Valley. I mean, this is a serious business. I mean, there's the intentionality, as George has rightly pointed out, to remake the Middle East.
Yes, and I would say there is also genocide explicitly. What is happening in Gaza is a genocide, and I think Israel and its co-perpetrating allies in the West are capable of committing more genocides, right? They're climbing up this ladder again, which leads from just war crimes to crimes against humanity and then genocide at the top of it, as it were, to put it very bluntly. And nothing ever stops them, right? If they feel like it, they'll do it. So Iran is in a world where it has learned that nothing will protect you. The UN cannot protect you. International law cannot protect you. Even if the highest court of the UN, the International Court of Justice, essentially rules against Israel and conducts a further investigation, or not an investigation, but continues this trial, that has made absolutely no difference, neither to Israel nor to its supporters. Absolutely none. The world we live in is the world in which the West is now a gigantic rogue actor. Many people would, of course, argue the West has been a gigantic rogue actor for centuries, and that's probably true. But right now, we are looking at a particularly egregious form of that, right? They've pulled out all the stops. They don't care at all anymore, right? So I think Iran must acquire nuclear weapons. I wish they already have them, but I don't think they do quite. But I also think they must acquire the means to deliver them. And they must acquire the means to deliver them, particularly, I'm afraid to say this, to the United States. Because Iran must acquire the specific capacity to deter not only Israel, but the United States. In that sense alone, Iran has to become more like North Korea. It has to have the ability to strike American targets, not only in the region, but in the American homeland. That's the logic of deterrence. The Americans have practiced it everywhere, all around the globe. And it seems to be the only thing that works with them anymore, because they've gone completely rogue. They're completely out of control. Let me add one last thing. What we have also learned in Gaza in particular is that if you use enough conventional weapons, we've known this always, you can do the same damage as you can do with a nuclear bomb. Yes, there are some differences, radiation and so on. But if you add up the sheer explosive power that the Israelis have pumped into Gaza, we know it's several Hiroshima or Nagasaki bombs already, and these were the first atomic bombs. So Iran looks at a world in which it is confronting existential danger, and I think there's absolutely no choice for it already, but to develop nuclear weapons and capable means of delivering them to both Israel and the USA to deter both.
You know, George, another pathetic aspect to all of this, I mean, nuclear weapons is basically a bad idea for humanity, but we have them, okay? But we're going backwards. I mean, what non-proliferation was a big thing as all of us were coming up, you know. I mean, because when we all know that if Iran acquires the bomb, well, Saudi Arabia probably will, and then you have other countries doing, and then we're going in the wrong direction, all because of one country, Israel.
Well, I think it's true, but at the same time, you can say that the non-proliferation treaty was based on an illusion. It was always unlikely that other powers are simply going to accept the premise that, well, we have only these five nuclear powers, no one else is to have them, and you know, you are to accept your lot in life that you don't have them, and that if you fall out of line, then you get hit over the head. And, pretty soon afterwards, after all, India and Pakistan both developed nuclear weapons. Israel, even probably at the time of the signing of the non-proliferation treaty, Israel already probably had them. So, it's surprising, really, in the sense that it's taken that many years for so many other powers to realize that, well, this doesn't give us any security, because we can actually be targeted whenever the great powers, and it's basically the United States, whenever the United States decides that they're going to take us out. There's no question. North Korea realized long ago that its only chance of survival is to develop nuclear weapons, North Korea is a small state. It's a vulnerable state. But it did find the means to survive. And now, essentially, no one messes with North Korea. And so Tariq is absolutely right. So Iran I think it has to. I mean, there has no real choice in the matter. It is in a very vulnerable situation. It has no choice but to develop nuclear weapons and to develop the delivery systems for the nuclear weapons to reach not just Israel. I mean, obviously, Iran has those capabilities now, but to reach the United States, because it's the United States that is the key player here. The United States backs Israel. The interesting thing will be, well, what happens with Russia and China? How will Russia and China respond to essentially any new moves on the part of the United States to say, well, we've got to do something about Iran. Look, Iran is violating the non-proliferation treaty. Iran is violating international law. Let's go back to the era when Russia and China signed on to all the various UN Security Council resolutions against Iran. I don't think Russia and China will go along with this time because this is part of the whole multipolarity. Well, if you want multipolarity, then this is really the only way to do it. You know, economically, you're not going to get multipolarity. Mm-hmm. Iran is just not strong enough economically to be a major economic power. But if Iran has nuclear weapons, then you are moving towards multipolarity. You are moving towards other powers being able to wield power in the world.
You know, Tariq, the fact that Israel is committing a genocide, has committed a genocide in Gaza, appears to want to repeat the same thing in Lebanon here. I mean, if a country is willing to commit genocide, then it will use nuclear weapons. I mean, that there's a certain logic to it. There's no taboo.
But there's that, and there's also the fact that, of course, Israel is a perfect nuclear rogue state, right? Officially, its nuclear weapons exist, but they don't exist, right? And as always, Israel has this extraordinary privilege that no laws apply to it, even in that sphere, right? That makes it even worse. But you're absolutely right that a country that commits genocide and commits genocide as easily and as lustily as the Israelis do, I would have to say, is of course capable of using nukes. In fact, they talked about nukes for Gaza, right? And I think the only thing that holds them back every time is that they don't want to deal with the after effects of a nuclear explosion, frankly. Now, what is more, I think, immediately the concern is that countries that have nuclear weapons can impose themselves on others and their power on others with conventional weapons, and there's no getting back at them. Right? That is the problem. And ideally, I would hope for a future in, you know, Western Asia or the Middle East, where we would finally see an Israel that is deterred by Iranian nuclear weapons and has to rely on conventional weapons alone, facing a coalition of conventionally well-armed opponents who will take it out. That is my dream for the future of the Middle East.
Well, and that's considering too, that some events are unfolding, that may be the only way forward. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump.
So.
We're going to go and take a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with our clue. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. Let me go to Georgia. We're going to change gears here. It's a truism, you know, in American presidential politics and during campaigns, foreign policy very rarely is, front and center. You could say like Vietnam 68, 72, that played a role, the anti-war movement. But very rarely since then, and I think it was an exception, that it doesn't really profile very high. But in this election, it is very, very different in a way. Of course, as we spoke in the first part of the program about West Asia or Middle East with Iran maybe acquiring the bomb. And then, we have the Biden administration's position on all of this, dividing the party in many ways, not its leadership. The Republican Party is using this as a wedge issue, so they're more pro-Israel than the Democratic Party, at least that's what they want to say. And Iran also is apparently threatening the life of Donald Trump, which, no surprise, everybody, no surprise that suddenly Iran's in domestic politics, too. I mean, George, what's important to me is that, okay, number one, it's in the campaign. But it's essentially bipartisan. That's why it's there. Go ahead, George.
Well, in a way, it's bipartisan, but there are distinctions. And you're right about the truism about, oh, foreign policy doesn't play a role. And yet in just about every election, foreign policy does play a role. I mean, you know, you go back to...
Well, maybe among voters, maybe not among the campaigns. Yeah, I agree.
Let's say you got in the 1960 election, you had Jack Kennedy distinguishing the Democrats and the Republicans by saying, well, we're really going to be ready to build up American military. America has been asleep at the switch. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you think about 1976, Jimmy Carter attacked the Republicans for pursuing the detente policy. So no, we got to, you know, start addressing the issue of human rights in the Soviet Union. And that was subsequently had some influence on the Carter administration. Again, Reagan, you know, they said, oh, Jimmy Carter was too weak in international affairs. And again, go back to Bill Clinton in 92, he was saying somehow, oh, Bush had been, you know, he'd been toasting the butchers of Beijing. Bush was insufficiently agitated about human rights violations in Bosnia and Herzegovina. So, and then even Trump, you know, you go back to Trump, I mean, in 2016, no more of these foreign interventions. America has to address some domestic issues. Well, what's happened this time is that you've got Harris, who's actually gone back to the same Democratic playbook, which is, oh, Trump likes dictators. Trump is pro-Putin. Trump doesn't care about Ukraine. Trump wants Russia to win in Ukraine. And then you've got Trump, who's kind of saying about the Democrats, oh, the Democrats want Hamas to win. You know, they're not sufficiently supportive of Israel. Well, you know, are people paying attention to that? They're paying some attention, and in a close election, and you know, we don't know if it'll be close, but you know, the polls indicate they're close. It could make a difference. Mm. I mean, that is something, it'll make a difference.
Tariq, what's also interesting to me, I guess we could use the vice presidential debate as a point of order. You know, George is right. I mean, maybe it's marginal. Sometimes it's more than marginal when it comes to the final vote. But I mean, if you look at both campaigns, they're, in my opinion, I'm sure you're going to agree with me, they're foreign policy illiterate. Okay, I mean, the way they frame all of the way they frame what's going on in West Asia, what's going on with Iran, what's going on with China. I mean, it is, you know, they may be throwing accusations at each other, but it's the Overton window is like that. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Look, I would put it like this. I would distinguish between foreign policy, which these campaigns are offering, and I totally agree it's all illiterate, and events taking place abroad, foreign events. And the question is, do these events have an effect in and of themselves? And look, if you factor in the swing state situation, the battleground state situation, 7 or 8 right now, including Michigan, Pennsylvania, the biggest in electoral college, all this stuff, right? And if you factor in Jill Stein, then I think you get to a point where actually foreign policy, and in particular the problem or the issue of the Gaza genocide, may have a very palpable effect, right? That's the weird thing about the American political system, that it's this solid two-party system that actually Americans are not very happy about. I remember a poll from 2000 reading about it, where a quarter of them said they liked the two-party system, a quarter, right? The rest don't. But at the same time, depending on where these third-party candidates stand and from whom they take on what issues, they can actually, under certain circumstances, really decide an election, right? And I think Jill Stein, combined with her position on Palestine, Israel, and the Gaza genocide, might in the end decide the election against Harris. And let me put this very clearly, Harris absolutely deserves it, of course, right? Absolutely. So the foreign policy issue is there, if they want it or not, I feel.
Yeah, but it's interesting with mentioning Jill Stein, because you know, the further you move away from it, she really is. I mean, the people that don't even like her are because they see both the Republicans and the Democrats as being on team genocide. So she's kind of like this default position. You know, you may not like what she has to say about, you know, the Green New Deal or, other social issues, but she's the single one And I think that's what makes it anomalous, because, you know, I can't remember a third party candidate that was people ended up focusing on foreign policy and, you know, and something as genocide. So, I mean, it is rather peculiar that way, George.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes, it is. It is very peculiar. But as we found in 2016, you know, the foreign policy dimension of an election thus has a subsequent influence on events. So we know in 2016, you know, the Democrats rage about losing this election to this talk show host, you know, spilled over into this Russiagate hoax, and that had absolutely catastrophic foreign policy implications. But something like that could be happening now. I think if Trump wins, I think there's certainly a possibility that he could just move on Ukraine and try to wrap that up. I mean, again, we don't know, but that's at least a possibility. He has made all sorts of noises, which indicates that he wants this war to end. Again, we don't know if that's the case. And at the same time, if he wins, he could well give the green light to Netanyahu, you know, whatever you want. I mean, that's pretty much what he's saying. Mm. Hey, wrap it up. Do whatever is necessary. I mean, you know, he's even said that Netanyahu should target nuclear installations in Iran. So they could absolutely have, you know, those sorts of influences. So by the same token, if Harris wins, I think she could well escalate in Ukraine. I mean, she made they say, hey, well, you know, this is you know, I made this my issue. Trump isn't doing enough on Ukraine. Trump is pro-Putin, Putin and puppet and whatever. I'm going to really, you know, give Ukraine whatever else it wants. So it could absolutely have a subsequent influence on events.
Well, Tariq, I mean, you know, if Trump does prevail, I'm peddling my own theory. He may win the election, but I don't think he'll be inaugurated. But maybe that's a topic for another program. But you know, at the end of the day, and we can, you know, we've gone back and forth on this program about how a future administration would deal with Ukraine, but I don't think it will change at all when it comes to Palestine at all.
I think you're right. I like George, think that there is a real chance that Trump as president, if he becomes president, could make a difference regarding the Ukraine war. But concerning Palestine, Israel, the problem is that these both camps have outcompeted each other in being pro-Israeli and pro-genocide, right? Going by that record, but I would add one wrinkle. I would add one wrinkle, which I find interesting about Trump. Trump has, on several occasions in the past, shown that he has a very healthy fear of nuclear war. He understands this and he's still afraid of it, and rightly so. And to connect back to what we were talking about, I almost have a feeling that if Iran managed a breakthrough and a breakout and would suddenly be able to say, we have the nukes, we can deter you. In fact, Trump would be the preferable president to be in place in such a scenario in the future, because he's very transactional. I don't think his loyalty to anyone or anything is absolute or highly emotional, as it seems to be in addition to other factors with the Democrats. And I could see him actually scale back the Israel support under that particular condition, only under that particular condition. And that's, of course, highly speculative.
Well, George, let's continue with that scenario here. But, George, who is going to enact that policy around him? Mike Pompeo? See, this is the problem here.
I think
his foreign policy was hijacked when he was president. Go ahead, George.
Yes, I think so. And I think that there is, I take Tariq's point, you know, Trump is transactional, but there may be an emotional dimension to his feelings about Iran. It was always very strange why in 2015, 2016, he suddenly developed this deep animus towards Iran. I mean, I know the story, but yes, he needed the donors and the money. But nonetheless, he has retained this. And over and over again, he brings up the subject of Iran. And now the intelligence agencies, perhaps, you know, knowing what may be coming, are briefing him. Oh, you know, they want you dead. You know, they're absolutely out to get you. And even Biden has now repeated that, oh, Iran's we're going to protect Trump from Iran. So it's going to be hard for him, I think, you know, to turn around after January the 20th and say, well, you know, I think we should work out a deal with Iran. So, I mean, I actually do think that he probably would give the green light
I want to end on one point here. One of the things that Trump is very proud of his presidency, he didn't start any new wars. I wonder... That's something that he will want to continue because he's got a lot of kudos for it. People say it. It's really important. But we'll find out if he is inaugurated, in fact, in January. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Budapest and Istanbul. And, of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk News.